Most merciful, the most beneficent, Mu'mineen and Mu'minat, I would like to begin today's lecture again by inviting all of you and thanking you for being here. Today is the second lecture in the series of lectures that will continue until the 15th of September, inshallah. So we hope to see you there. As mentioned yesterday, these lectures will start off with the tilawat of the Quran. There will be a salam, and then the Sheikh will deliver a lecture. Today's program will also have a short noha, and after the noha, there's a question and answer session. So if your question was missed yesterday, I would urge you to send it on again today. I made a note of it, but just in case I missed it, I would like you to send it again to the admin. If your question was missed yesterday, or if there are any questions that arise during today's lecture, thank you so much for attending, for being here. And then without further delay, I would like to invite Brother Shayan Hedri, to come forward and recite the Holy Quran for us, please. Shayan, thank you.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. Wa
rahmatullahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. والسماء والطارق وما أدراك ما الطارق النجم الثاقب إن كل نفس لما عليها حافظ فلينظر الإنسان مما خلق خلق مما إن دافق يخرج من بين الصلب والترائب إنه على رجعه لقادر يوم تبلى السرائر فما له من قوة على ناصر والسماء ذات الرجع والأرض ذات الصدع إنه لقول فصل وما هو بالهزل إنهم يكيدون كيدا وأكيد كيدا فمهل الكافرين أمهلهم رويدا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad wa ajil farajahum. Thank you, Shayan, so much for your beautiful recitation of Surah Tariq. Next, I would like to invite Brother Ali Mujtaba to recite the salam for us. Ali, are you here?
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. Wa rahmatullah.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. O Hussein, Ya Mawla, how I wish I was there at Karbala. How I wish, how I pray that I was with you that day. How I wish I could have been with Muslim so that I would have been martyred instead of him. How I wish that you asked me to bring the water so that my arms were amputated instead of your brother. How I wish that I could have taken the arrow so that your son Ali Asghar could have lived tomorrow. How I wish that my brother and I could have fought so that Zainab's on and Muhammad would have not. How I wish that I could have fought in place of Akbar so that you could hear his beautiful azan at Fajr. How I wish I had the strength of Akbar, who is now with your grandfather. How I wish I had the loyalty of your brother, so that my sins would not drag me into the fire. How I wish that the throat slit was not yours but mine. If only I could go back in time. How I wish I could have stopped Hormala when he aimed the arrow at you, Mola. I know that the time of Imam is near, and I say this knowing he can hear. Ya Allah, Ya Khuda, grant me the strength on my journey, which Abbas showed with his loyalty. Bestow upon me the courage to side with right, just like Hur, who made the choice with might. Don't allow my patience to falter, just like Sajjad, who didn't have water. Provide me with Zainab's vision, so that I can make the right decision. I now raise my hands in dua. I wish to be like a bus for my Aqa. O Hussein, Ya Mola, how I wish I was there at Karbala. How I pray that I was with you that day. Salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. It's truly with such a beautiful sentiment and one that echoes throughout a lot of the Yazidat and Zaireen that come at the door of Imam Hussein, and even when you're walking to Karbala, if you have been blessed with the opportunity to visit Imam Hussein. And if not so, I pray that you are blessed with the opportunity to go to see and fulfill the ziyarah of Imam Hussein and the A'immah, that you have this undying desire that you wish you were there. But I suppose we can still find solace in the fact that we have an imam of our time. And just the way we wish that we could have been with Imam Hussein, maybe we should then in turn consolidate our efforts towards strengthening our faith and strengthening our belief to a point where we can stand firmly with the followers of our imam when the time comes to give our hands, like our arms, like Hazrat Abbas did, or to get an arrow in the chest, a spear in the chest, like Hazrat Ali Akbar. The chance and opportunity for martyrdom still remains alive today. It's as much as how much we want to do, how much we want to fight. For example, we have the example of Sheikh Zakzaki in Nigeria. We have the people. We have the example of people starving in Yemen, again done by the Taghut. So as the Sheikh also mentioned, like, we have a responsibility towards our imams. The commands of our imams are there. And continuing on from his topic, which is focused on the special companions of the imams and how we can learn from them, the Sheikh will be continuing his lecture today. I would once again like to remind you there will be a small noha or a letim after the lecture concludes for about 3 to 4 minutes, after which we will continue our question and answer session. So any questions that may arise, or if your question was left over from yesterday, I would like you to send it to the host, Babylon Society, again today, please. Thank you. Now, without further delay, I would like to invite our main speaker, Agha Sheikh Hamza Saudagar, today to come and join us and begin his speech now. Sheikh, are you with us?
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين بارئ الخلائق أجمعين باعث الأنبياء والمرسلين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المكرمين المنتجبين لا سيما بقية الله في الأراضين روحي وأرواح العالمين لتراب مقدمه الفداء ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين إلى قيام يوم الدين. For the hastening the return of our Imam, let's recite the salawat. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. Before I begin, I would like to thank the brother who recited the salam before the speech. It is difficult to find English recitations, and it is more difficult to find good English recitations. And this recitation was both English and it was a very good recitation, both in terms of tune, in terms of meaning. And in terms of meaning, it went beyond the average, even original language, nohas and recitations and salams and so on and so forth. Inshallah, the brother has more tawfiq to prepare more and put together more such recitations, poetry, and so on, and use this art in order to bring hearts in the direction that the Imam wants. And that is against what the material-minded artists that use their art to take people towards materialism and towards wanting and desiring and following their temptations and desires. This would be and is an art that is guided by the soul, guided by a heart, a believing heart that will guide other hearts and minds towards what is more important, which is our spiritual needs and our connection to the Imams, to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Inshallah, you have more tawfiq. Today, I want to talk a little bit about another companion of Amir al-Mu'mineen that we have probably heard his name as well. And he is also a companion of the Prophet, though he was younger comparatively. And that is Ammar ibn Yasir. Ammar was along with his parents, one of the early Muslimin believing in the Prophet. And that is a very proud thing to have. And Ammar did. He was a Meccan, one of those that were in those standards underprivileged, those who were not recognized as people of influence, people of stature. They were of the people of the ghettos, those types of people. And they were some of the first to accept the message of the Holy Prophet. His parents were, if not the first, which as far as I know, they're the first, but if not that, one of the first of the martyrs of Islam. They were tortured to death by the hands of the affluent and the elite of Mecca, trying to stop the growth and the progress of Islam by creating fear and making them as a model, torturing them and then killing them, so that people who are such, they don't have the backing of a strong tribe, as that's how they would seek protection in those days. People who don't have the backing of these tribes, people who don't have affluence, people who don't have a stature that will protect them, would think twice. And then there were other tactics used to scare off and to make sure that those who are amongst the elite don't join, although they did join as well. But from these, we find some really interesting qualities and very interesting and important points that we need to take on board. But I want to discuss Ammar, who lost his parents in that way in the early days of Islam and continued following the path of the Prophet, despite his parents losing their lives. He continued steadfast on the path. The time of Amir al-Mu'mineen, which is in turn split into two different chapters. One chapter is the chapter between the demise, and I'm talking about the imamah of Amir al-Mu'mineen, obviously, otherwise there's a few other chapters, but when Amir al-Mu'mineen becomes the imam after the demise of the Holy Prophet, the chapters are two mainly. One is the period that he is not officially the ruler, the governor. Those are 25 years. And then the 5 years of ruling that Amir al-Mu'mineen had. Both of those are very critical and very crucial times. However, in many ways, as Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi mentioned in his first sermon delivered after the people came to his door, they flocked to his door in large numbers, begging him to lead them. He gave delivered a sermon telling them that now we have returned to the times of the Prophet, and therefore there are going to be fitan, there will be many fitnas that we will be involved in, and so on and so forth. Ammar ibn Yasir, this companion of the Prophet, who is now the companion of Amir al-Mu'mineen, has an important quality that Amir al-Mu'mineen, upon losing Ammar is not only the son of two shaheeds, his parents were martyred during the time of the Prophet by the hands of the Umayyads, who were the elite of Mecca, the leaders of Quraysh. The elite were predominantly led by Abu Sufyan, who was an Umayyad, the father of Muawiyah. His parents were killed by the hands of those, and Ammar was killed by the hands of the son of the Muawiyah in the Battle of Siffin. He was a martyr. Upon his martyrdom, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi calls upon him after he is martyred at times where he needs that quality of Ammar amongst his companions. There's a famous, very unfortunate thing to hear. In other words, it brings tears to one's eyes and grief to one's heart to hear this. Amir al-Mu'mineen saying, Aina Ammar? Where's Ammar? I need Ammar now, and there's no Ammar. What is the quality of Ammar that although Amir al-Mu'mineen had other companions, there were others around him, there were supporters. Amir al-Mu'mineen says, Aina Ammar? What is that quality that Amir al-Mu'mineen wants in his companions and he's finding so little? And that companion or that quality that Amir al-Mu'mineen finds in Ammar reveals itself on many different occasions. And it's something that Amir al-Mu'mineen actually mentioned in that initial sermon that he gave right after people came to him and begged him, and in his own words, almost forced him to accept Khilafah. He said that there are going to be fitan, and he mentioned what the quality of those who will be able to continue on this path will be. And that is, لَا يَحْمِلُ هَذَا الْعَلَمْ إِلَّا أَهْلُ الْبَصَرِ وَالصَّابْرَ. No one will be able to carry this banner and to be with it except those who possess patience. And first, he says, of course, I went wrong with the order. Ahlul basari was sabr, those who possess insight, vision, and patience. Those two qualities are very important. The focus in the case of Ammar is the quality of basar, vision. That was something that Amir al-Mu'mineen required amongst his companions. He spoke with vision, Amir al-Mu'mineen did. No one's insight is comparable. But because of the political context, because of the difficulty of the fitan, having someone else that explains in a different way the same message of Amir al-Mu'mineen and echoes it is needed in order for the people whose minds and hearts are not as strong to hear another voice echoing that message, for them to be able to process that and accept that. That happens many times. The reason why the enemies of Islam have multiple mouthpieces, multiple media outlets repeating the same thing over and over. CNN repeats something over and over. They invite guests, different programs, they repeat the same thing. They show it again and again. They bring different politicians. Then you have the other news outlets with their superficial differences, but essentially being the same, whether it's the British media or the American media, Fox News in the US or BBC or Sky in Britain, and all the other ones worldwide, these being the main ones that are influencing public opinion globally, they repeat. It's not one person. The Queen of England doesn't even come out and speak. I don't even think she has any ability in that area, if she has any ability besides evil in her. Amir al-Mu'mineen's ability to speak is beyond all. His ability to see, his vision, his insight is above all. However, repetition and having others understanding him and repeating that influences the weaker minds, the ones that require more to be convinced. Ones who do not have enough insight themselves, enough vision themselves, enough understanding and intellect in them, they're weaker in that area. Hearing the logic that Amir al-Mu'mineen presents is too difficult for them to process. Hearing two or three different voices saying the same thing makes them feel that this is right. This is very common. This is a reality that is there. So Amir al-Mu'mineen calling for Ammar, Aina Ammar. He needs someone else to echo the same message. And according to that, there doesn't seem to be anyone that is able to see the way Ammar saw when he was alive, and explain the way Ammar explained. So two qualities, it's essentially one, but there's two aspects of it. One is basira for himself, insight for himself. The other is providing insight for others. After seeing himself, what the truth is, what the right thing is, what the right path is, after identifying that, seeing that clearly, then being able to present that to an audience, to be a second voice to Amir al-Mu'mineen's, following that lead and enabling more people to see. This is very important, and we need to learn that, brothers and sisters. We have got to learn that. The reason why the people of the world are confused about the truths, and because of their confusion, they end up following or at least allowing for all the evils worldwide to occur. Do you think if the American people, who are for the most part confused, not evil, if the American people realized what they are allowing to happen globally, things that they talk about and they consider so evil and so wrong amongst themselves, but their confusion is causing all of that to happen in Palestine, in Yemen, in Arabia, in Pakistan, in India, in the Philippines, in Southeast Asia, in China, in Japan, in Europe, in Africa, in South America, in Cuba, in Colombia, all these areas where the evil claws of this monster US government is spread and is causing all these problems. If the people of the United States realize what it is, and after realizing, decided to at least not allow it to happen, not only not support it, but decide that we're not going to be part of making this possible, do we think that this, they would be able to do this. One of the reasons why they have all these tools of forming public opinion is because they need public support. The reason why Colin Powell needs to sit there and lie with a straight face, as they always do in the UN Security Council, explaining that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, while he knew for a fact Saddam did not have weapons of mass destruction. Why they all knew that, but he needs to sit there with a straight face, looking all sincere and truthful, and presenting these false facts. But why does he need to do that? Why can't they just take troops to Iraq and just do whatever they want to do? Because they need people. They need people's support. They need people to understand, to want, or at least be okay with this. If they can't convince people to be at least non-opposing to this, they will have a very difficult time just having people on the streets against these decisions. Is difficult for them to handle, much less if the numbers grow and they become very large numbers against wars. It'll be very difficult. That's why they try, they have all these instruments. Muawiyah, during the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen, took very similar measures compared to what we see in the media here. All the lies, you know, the whole war against Amir al-Mu'mineen, that Muawiyah ended up bringing 75,000 people from Sham, despite the fact that the area he governed, which is Sham or Shamat, was much smaller compared to the area that was governed by Amir al-Mu'mineen. Amir al-Mu'mineen controlled the rest of the Islamic Empire, from Egypt, which had its large population and very vast lands and resources and so on and so forth, to all of the Arabian Peninsula, to Azerbaijan, to parts of Persia that had been conquered. All of those areas are under the authority and control of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Amir al-Mu'mineen sent governors to Isfahan in Iran. If you look at the map, how far east that goes, those were sort of close to the borders of the Islamic Empire with the other empire. Amir al-Mu'mineen controlled this entire region. Muawiyah only had Sham, which is pretty much roughly where Syria is today. This is what Muawiyah had. Even Palestine apparently was not under his authority and control. Jordan perhaps was not under his control and authority, apparently. I'm not 100% sure about this. Despite the fact that the areas that are under the control of these two rulers, one being a just ruler, Amir al-Mu'mineen, the other being Muawiyah, was an unjust ruler, Muawiyah is able to bring 75,000 people to fight Ali ibn Abi Talib, the son-in-law of the Prophet, the one appointed by the Prophet in Ghadir, the one that all these companions have pledged allegiance to. Muawiyah is able to bring 75,000. How many is Amir al-Mu'mineen able to take to fight him? 45,000 from predominantly Kufa. What about other cities? They're not there. And perhaps, of course, Amir al-Mu'mineen didn't require them to come. I'm not trying to draw any conclusions that the others were called upon and they refused to come. I don't know about that. But clearly, Amir al-Mu'mineen had more support in Kufa. 45,000 against them. How did Muawiyah bring 75,000 Muslimin, Qurra, those who believed in the Prophet, those who believed in the Quran, those who read the Quran, those who spread and talked about the sayings of the Prophet, like the Sunnah of the Prophet, how did he bring these people to fight Ali ibn Abi Talib? It was all based on false accusations against Amir al-Mu'mineen. The death of Uthman was blamed on Ali ibn Abi Talib, whereas the death of Uthman, beyond all, is to be blamed on Muawiyah himself. Now that for another time, but keep that in mind. Make sure that at some point you follow that history. Muawiyah is the one who is responsible for the death of Uthman. Amir al-Mu'mineen, despite the fact that Uthman is usurping the right of Ali ibn Abi Talib in ruling, Amir al-Mu'mineen sends the two imams, the two next imams, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, the grandsons of the Prophet, to take water and food to Uthman. And he tells people and the rebellion against him, you are not supposed to be attacking Uthman in this way. You should be trying to correct his behavior. And he spends all the effort he had in trying to do that. Unfortunately, Uthman, with the people around him, refused. And so there was no choice left for Amir al-Mu'mineen except for him to leave Medina. He wasn't responsible for the death of Uthman. The people who led the battle of Jamal, Aisha, Zubayr, Talha, and others along with them, they were responsible for the death of Uthman. In fact, Talha and Zubayr were some of those who, along with Aisha, who encouraged people to kill Uthman. But the main guilt goes to is on Muawiyah, rahmatullah alayh. He's the one responsible for it. The clever, evil genius. He's the one that caused the death of Uthman. Again, proving that and explaining that requires some other time. But the one who is responsible for the death of Uthman takes 75,000 people willing to fight Ali ibn Abi Talib, not for bucks, not for money, but thinking religiously they need to fight Ali ibn Abi Talib. Based on what? A lie that Ali ibn Abi Talib is responsible for the death of the successor to the Prophet. He used similar tactics and he got all those people to come. To fight whom? Ali ibn Abi Talib, that is the best ruler for them. If they would have wanted Ali ibn Abi Talib to rule over them, they would have had paradise on earth. He's the most competent, the most pious, the most knowledgeable in all areas. You want to go and fight this man? They willingly went. Why? Based on a lie that is presented to them in a way where they believe it. Believed it. In the story of Karbala, although it's different in many ways, it's not like that. People who went to Karbala did not have any confusion that Hussein ibn Ali salamullah alayh is doing nothing wrong. And they had no confusion that Yazid was doing everything wrong. They went for bribes. They went for money. They went out of fear. That's what they went there. But the people that went out with Muawiyah, they were there religiously fighting Ali ibn Abi Talib. Tyrants of the world need public opinion. They need public opinion to side with them. Or at least for public opinion to be confused enough not to be against them. They need that. So what are they going to do? They're going to be spreading all these different lies, so many of them on so many different levels, to simply, again, create confusion at least, and to get enough people to side with them to carry out their evil goals and objectives. So Amir al-Mu'mineen says, لا يحمل هذا العلم إلا أهل البصر والصبر. No one will be able to carry this banner, banner of the Ahlul Bayt, the banner of Islam, the banner of Tawheed, the banner of the Quran, the real Quran, not the Qurans on the spheres, not the Quran used by the tyrants, not the masjid used by tyrants, not the adhan that Yazid has recited. Adhan of Islam, the Allahu Akbar of Islam, the Quran of Islam. All those are very important examples. Maybe I'll try to get to some of them as well. Ammar is someone that has insight. Let me talk about a few examples of the insights of Ammar, those very critical points in time, critical moments in time that the insight and vision of Ammar played a very important role in the direction of the Muslimin and people following the path of Haqq, path of truth. Perhaps if Ammar was still alive when they tried to, when they put the Qur'ans on the spears in the battle of Siffin, that was after his Shahada, if Ammar was alive, perhaps they wouldn't have been able to pull that off against Amir al-Mu'mineen, because Ammar would have been there and his words would have changed the scene, echoing the voice of Ali ibn Abi Talib in his own way and causing people to rethink this. One of the critical points that Ammar's insights came into play is when Amir al-Mu'mineen sent Imam al-Mujtaba along with Ammar to Kufa to gather troops for the Battle of Jamal. The first battle Amir al-Mu'mineen fought after he was the ruler is the Battle of Jamal, the Battle of the Camel, which was led by Aisha, Umm al-Mu'mineen, the wife of the Prophet. This is a title that Quran gives, but it's not necessarily a title that is respectful. It's supposed to suggest that the relationship of the mu'mineen with these women is like the relationship of a man with their mother. They can't marry them. That's the idea of Umm al-Mu'mineen. The verse of the Quran that refers to them as وَأَزْوَاجُهُ أُمَّهَاتُكُمْ, his wives, the Prophet's wives, are your mothers, is suggesting that you cannot marry them after his demise. No mu'min was allowed to marry them. Aisha could never get married to anyone after the demise of the Prophet. That's a difference between the Prophet and others. If anyone else passes away, their wife is still alive. Their wife is allowed to get married to others after the iddah comes to an end. The wives of the Prophet were not allowed to get married to other mu'mineen. And that relationship is similar to the relationship a man has with his mother. You can never, al-ayadu billah, it's a great sin for anyone to get married to their mother. And so the relationship between the believers and Aisha was that no one, and the other wives of the Prophet that lived after his demise. The Quran says they are like your mother. You can't marry them. So when we say Ummul Mu'mineen, it doesn't mean that she's a great woman. She could have been, but she chose not to, unfortunately. The wives of the Prophet that were good, like Umm Salama, they chose to be good. Khadija Salamullah alayhi, the best wife of the Prophet, she chose to be good. So anyhow, Umm al-Mu'mineen Aisha was the one of the main figures encouraging people to fight Ali ibn Abi Talib along with Talha and Zubayr. These were companions of the Prophet. Unfortunately, they went astray. They were all involved with the death of Uthman one way or another, and yet they gathered people against Ali ibn Abi Talib to fight him. One of the things they mentioned against him was a hand over the killers of Uthman, which they were the killers of Uthman. Amir al-Mu'mineen mentions that to them. Anyhow, so once they started creating their rebellion, they started their rebellion moving from Mecca or from Medina towards Basra, taking that city over and doing a lot of creating havoc over there in Basra. Amir al-Mu'mineen gathered troops and he went towards them. Not too many people came from Medina and Mecca, from Hijaz. Amir al-Mu'mineen sent Imam al-Mujtaba and Ammar to Kufa to gather troops for him over there. They went to the Jama', the Masjid of Kufa. Those who've been for Ziyarah, inshallah, they remember. And those who haven't, inshallah, they get to go and they see that great grand mosque of Kufa. It's one of the larger mosques we have in the Muslim world from the old days. They gather over there, they gather the people, and they begin to speak. Let me remind us that this is a very critical time. Amir al-Mu'mineen needs troops. What happens in Kufa is that there are multiple influential figures in Kufa. One of those figures is Abu Musa al-Ash'ari. The Ash'aris are generally people of Yemen that moved to Kufa, including Malik al-Ashtar An-Nakhai, which inshallah tomorrow we'll be discussing Malik and what good qualities he had that we need to aspire to develop in ourselves. He was also of Yemeni descent. Many Yemenis moved over to Kufa. They were the warriors that defeated the Persians and they settled in Kufa. Abu Musa is someone who enjoys a lot of influence, respect. He's seen as a very religious figure, outwardly religious. He's a companion of the Prophet. He's heard things from the Prophet. He knows the Quran. And so obviously amongst Muslimin, this type of figure is going to have a lot of respect. And he's someone from Kufa. Ammar comes from outside. Imam al-Mujtaba is the grandson of the Prophet, but the people of Kufa are not as familiar with Ammar or Imam al-Mujtaba as they are with Abu Musa al-Ash'ari. Abu Musa has led prayers, he's had different positions there, he spent his time there, all these people know him. These are all elements that cause a person to have more influence, his words to carry more weight, even if they're stupid, even if they're meaningless, even if they're absolute lies, even if they're completely wrong. But if someone like that stands and says something, more people are going to listen to that individual. When Imam al-Mujtaba, Amir al-Mu'minin sent Imam al-Mujtaba deliberately, Imam al-Mujtaba is a grandson of the Prophet. That itself, even if they don't know him, that itself gives a lot more influence to the words that are given as compared to if Amir al-Mu'minin would have sent simply a couple of companions of the Prophet that the people of Kufa didn't know. Ammar was not very well known in Kufa, from what we read. But he was a companion of the Prophet. They knew, they'd heard, and those who knew more knew, but they weren't as acquainted with him. They didn't have contact with him as much. If Amir al-Mu'minin would have sent only them, then it would have had less weight. It would have been less productive. Imam al-Mujtaba was sent, but that wasn't enough. Imam al-Mujtaba stands, and this is why it wasn't enough. We'll explain. Imam al-Mujtaba stands and delivers a sermon and tells people, this is why you need to join, this is what's happened, this is what happened in Medina. People came to Ali ibn Abi Talib, they wanted him, they pledged allegiance, so he's the legitimate ruler based on the track record, you know, because Islamically he was the rightful ruler regardless, but based on the track record, this is how people pledged allegiance, and in this case it was actually a lot more people that came and willingly wanted that particular Khalifa. So this happened and that happened and so on and so forth. Now they have gone and Talha, Zubayr and these people, they've gone over to Basra. They've created havoc. There's this going on, that going on. And Amir al-Mu'minin has sent me to gather troops. We need to go and deal with these. Imam al-Mujtaba gives that sermon. Abu Musa al-Ash'ari is mal'oon, that creates problems. He stands and he says the following. He says, I heard the Prophet say that there will be fitnas and you should remain silent. You should not take sides. He's explained, these are his words. He says you shouldn't take sides because I heard the Prophet say that there will be a fitna that arises within Muslimin that you shouldn't speak. And so he encourages the people not to take sides. Don't be with, and this is a big problem, and maybe at some point we're going to, it makes it sound like, oh, it's pillory. Let's not take sides. It's not clear. Let's not take sides. This is what he's promoting. And if he would have been able to get people to simply do that, I mean, he would have been left without troops. They don't have to join. People didn't have to join Talha and Zubayr for the damage to be done. All they needed to do was not join Ali ibn Abi Talib. Ali ibn Abi Talib would not have any troops to fight. This is one of the poisonous, venomous words of the shaitan that comes. It's not clear. Let's not take sides. Let's not take sides. Very, inshallah, some other time I'll try to explain that a bit more. Abu Musa al-Ash'ari tries to promote this idea, pushes this idea. Ammar is there. Look at the way he addresses this matter in this session here. They're all listening. They know he's a companion of the Prophet. Obviously, Imam al-Mujtaba, one of the issues, again, it's not the issue of Imam al-Mujtaba, it's the perception of the people. The people say, well, he's one of the parties involved in this dispute. If he speaks, this is the unfortunate thought process of people, not Imam al-Mujtaba. If he's speaking, he's biased. He's biased. Abu Musa al-Ash'ari is not seen as biased. He's not seen as someone that is with Talha, Zubayr, or Aisha. He's just seen as a religious man who's a companion of the Prophet. Now he's saying he heard the Prophet say this. Ammar responds. The response of Ammar is amazing. He says, he addresses him in a condescending way, to put him down and break his image as a companion of the Prophet, because he's going against Haq. You need to do that sometimes and in the right way. He addressed him in that way, and then he says that, you fool, you just went against what the Prophet said. The Prophet told you to remain silent in the face of fitna. You just spoke. You just spoke. You went against the saying of the Prophet. He mentioned these couple of words as the beginning of his talk to the people, explaining why they need to join Ali ibn Abi Talib. And that just put all of what he said to rest, because it was clear logic, correct logic and reason, delivered in the precise way that it needs to be. And it had the effect. The largest troops joined Amir al-Mu'minin from Kufa. If Ammar hadn't stood up there, if he wouldn't have clarified the misinformation that this mal'oon is presenting to the people, they would have not taken sides. Ali ibn Abi Talib would have been left without troops. Thousands joined. Thousands. Thousands joined. In the Battle of Siffin, many times, because these 75,000 people that had come from Sham had all come there based on a lie, many lies rather, Amir al-Mu'mineen, well, obviously the Ahlul Bayt's approach towards battle generally is this, that we don't start the battle, we defend ourselves. We go with troops. Amir al-Mu'mineen went with troops to Siffin, showed the fist, and said, you guys better get in line. But he doesn't use the fist. The enemies of Islam are the first to use the fist. Having the fist and showing the fist is an instrument, a tool utilized to get people who are not willing to get in line to get in line. You show the fist. You bring all the troops, you show the fist, but you don't use it. If they dare use it, then they're going to get hit really hard. And that's what happened. Amir al-Mu'mineen didn't start the battle. He never started any battle. Each of the battles in their own way. I don't want to get into those details. But besides not starting the battle, Amir al-Mu'mineen took the opportunity to talk, explain, have others talk, Ammar talk. Talk to the people of Sham. Get them to realize that you're not here for Islam. He has misled you to come here, qurbatan ilallah. It's not something good for you. It's not something Islamic. It's a lie. He did that, and many times, I don't have an accurate figure, but there were people who joined Amir al-Mu'mineen's side. And there were those who just left the battlefield. At least they didn't support Muawiyah any longer. It wasn't clear to them that Muawiyah is right anymore. All those souls were saved from fighting Ali ibn Abi Talib. At critical times where, not for the people of Sham, but Muawiyah tried to do the reverse. It wasn't only when the Qur'ans were on the spears that is the fitna that ended the war. That's not the only fitna of the Battle of Siffin. Many times Muawiyah tried to create fitan. To do what? Because the battle, although he came with larger numbers, Amir al-Mu'mineen was kicking his tail. with the less troops, 45,000 troops that he had, he was kicking Muawiyah's tail. And he knew he's got to do something. So he was scrambling different fitnas to get the people that are backing Ali ibn Abi Talib in the battle to change their minds. Who was there? Ammar. Ammar kept speaking. Explaining. Keeping the troops on Amir al-Mu'mineen's side. Then when they killed Ammar, then the fitnas increased. And Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, mazloom, does not have another person of the companions. Obviously, the grandchildren of the Prophet are there. Again, people's perception is that they're biased, unfortunately. This is the problem of the masses and the lack of insight and vision. That's the point right here. The people who have more insight, we need to aspire to become of those who have more understanding, more vision, more insight into matters. And then our job will be to present that and clarify it to the masses that have less insight. Imam al-Mujtaba is biased. Imam al-Hussein is biased. Amir al-Mu'mineen is biased. They are people that never speak anything but the truth. But the people think they're biased. Ali ibn Abi Talib is biased. He has grudges against Muawiyah. It's a feud. It's a family feud. It's a internal matter. They're all Quraysh. This is Umayyah. Those are Banu Umayyah. These are Banu Hashim. They're fighting each other because of that. All these different. Ammar, the likes of Ammar, who are not seen to have that bias. Many times leaders speak, the rightful leaders, good leaders, they speak. Their words are true. But because of all the misinformation and the low insight and vision of people, masses, those words are not heard. But then if you have someone that is not in that position, and that's you and I, brothers and sisters, we need to identify those leaders today. Connecting this to today, we need to identify those leaders that are to us, for us, in the absence of our imam, based on the words of our imam, are our leaders. We need to identify them and know that the enemies of Islam are going to be enemies of those leaders, and they're going to spread a lot of misinformation against those leaders, accuse them of a lot of things, accuse them of not having knowledge, not having ijtihad, not having taqwa, working for their own desires, temptations, worldly gains, and so on and so forth, being oppressive. The oppressors of the world accuse these just leaders as being oppressive, having police states, whereas they are the ones that even to their own people have police states. They spread this. We have got to be like Ammar for the leaders that the Imam of our time has told us. We need to consider them our leaders during the occultation. Identify that, and for the masses that can be swayed one way or another because of their lower level of vision to speak. One thing is, Ammar saw the truth in Ali ibn Abi Talib. He saw the falsehood, his ability to understand that Abu Musa al-Ash'ari is not lying. He heard the Prophet say, don't speak. But he understood more than Abu Musa, who was addressed by that talk, by that statement of the Prophet. Ammar understood more clearly what the Prophet meant. And he told him in front of all those people, you just went against what the Prophet said. This shows his understanding of what was happening, who Abu Musa is, what the Prophet meant there. At such a short, he didn't go spend hours think of, okay, what happened here? What did the Prophet say this? He's got this vision. He understood very clearly there. That's one thing. It didn't take him long to process what's happening because of that ability to understand, that insight, that vision. And then speaking clearly, giving insight to people on the spot, that requires courage. And It requires the ability to present that clarity in speech or in writing or in whatever format it may be. This is Ammar. Amir al-Mu'mineen says, Aina Ammar. I need Ammar. Aina Ammar is a statement recorded in history by Amir al-Mu'mineen, similar to the statement of Imam al-Hussein, Hal min nasirin yansuruni? Is there anyone to help me? It's recorded in history for us, brothers and sisters. Amir al-Mu'mineen's voice is being echoed by every imam and by the imam of our time for those he has sent for us to be led by during his occultation, based on his leadership. In other words, following those leaders based on the statement of the imam of our time is following the imam of our time. So the message of Aina Ammar is echoed by the imam of our time as well. Where are the Ammars? I need Ammars. Where are you to understand the plots of these enemies? Understand it. See what they're trying, where they're trying to go with their propaganda, with their media, with their lies. Not just on the matter of Palestine, those lies are now very evident what they are. There's so many. They want to change the direction of Islam from within. They are forcing brothers and sisters, not only Muslimin in Western lands, they are forcing Muslimin in Muslim lands to accept what Islam rejects categorically, to change the direction of Islam. They want Muslimin to accept LGBT. They want Muslimin to accept that it's perfectly fine if somebody chooses to marry the same gender. Whereas the Quran has said that forget about the marriage, even if without marriage, which there is no such thing as marriage. That's not even called marriage in any culture. They have changed the meaning of the word marriage for this ugly deed. If two men get involved with this act, the penal code is very severe. And God has showed us that what he did to a nation who decided to do this and decided to be okay with it collectively, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wiped all of them out, even those who didn't engage in it. The wife of Prophet Lut did not engage in the act. He was the wife of Prophet Lut. He was married. She was married to a man. She wasn't engaged in that nasty deed. Yet she was punished in the same way. Why? Because she was okay with it. She was okay with it. This is what Allah says about this deed. They want Muslimin in their lands, not only in the West, not only in Britain, not only in Ireland, not only in Europe, not only in the US or Canada. They want Muslimin in Arabia, in Hijaz, right by the Kaaba, for two Muslim men to go to Masjid al-Haram, al-Ayyadu Billah, and conduct their nikah in Masjid al-Haram. This is what they want. They have already passed that legislation in their so-called global body in the UN, United Nations. And they have gotten these governments to agree to it. The Emirat governments, they even got the Islamic Republic officials from the Islamic Republic to agree to it. The leader had to come out and say, how dare anyone sign this document? This is in no way going to be implemented here. We have Islam. We're Muslimin. Islam tells us what's right and wrong. The plots, these are plots. They're taking different measures to change the course of Islam, the ideology of Islam. They want to take martyrdom out of Islam. They want to take jihad out of Islam. They want it to seem like jihad is a bad word. Jihad is the most noble word you could imagine. But they've changed it in their media, jihadist. They want to go for jihad. Make it sound like a bunch of lunatics or mujahideen. Amir al-Mu'mineen is a mujahid. Amir al-Mu'mineen is someone who is the champion of jihad. He loves jihad fi sabilillah. Not a bunch of lunatics. Your Bin Laden is a CIA agent. He's not a mujahid. ISIS are CIA agents leading them. They're not mujahideen. Mujahideen are the believers like Haj Qasim Soleimani, who went and risked their lives to protect the people, and then the United States of America sends a drone just to kill Haj Qasim Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. You guys are the terrorists. You are the lunatics. But they flip it. See, the same way we said Muawiyah, who is responsible for the death of Uthman, makes Ali ibn Abi Talib seem to be responsible for the death of Uthman. The ones who are responsible for the killings of so many Muslimin and non-Muslimin are making it sound like Muslimin are responsible for the death of them. Blaming it on ISIS or whatever. You created ISIS. You created Al-Qaeda. And you have publicly stated it. And how stupid can people be? How much lack of insight creates problems for us. And those who see, they don't have the courage like Ammar to come out and explain, or they don't have the ability to come out and explain the way Ammar did. We have to see their lies. Have the courage. Try your best to clarify. And Allah will give you more of every one of those. Whatever insight you have, if you see something right that's being portrayed in the wrong way, have the courage, speak out and explain how that is wrong. And if you do that for Allah, Allah will grant you more insight and vision. And He will grant you more courage for something more difficult. And He will grant you more ability in your speech, in your pen, in your writing, in your poetry, in your recitation, whatever of these tactics that you have. And all of them are useful. All of them should be used. The arts in the different ways, in the form of speeches, poetry, recitations, imagery, cartoons, anything that is able to get a message across. Use it, what you have, for Allah. Allah will give you more, inshallah. Sallallahu alayka ya Abu Abdullah. Sallallahu alayka ya أيها الشهيد بكربلاء عطشانا. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you, my beloved Imam al-Hussein. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you, my beloved, oppressed Imam. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you, my blessed and beloved Imam, who was slaughtered by the shores of the Euphrates while his mouth was dry of thirst. Ruhi fidaka ya Mawla. The family of the Imam is preparing to move towards and enter Sham. Brothers and sisters, there's a narration from Imam Zain al-Abidin. They asked him, which was the most difficult part of this trip that you left Medina? You went to Mecca, from there towards Kufa, and then Karbala. From Karbala to Kufa, from Kufa to the other cities, all the way to Sham. And now back What part of this was most difficult? Imam Zain al-Abidin, according to the account, said three times, Asham, Asham, Asham. How difficult was it? Now Zainab is preparing, try to think what the people of Sham are preparing for. They're being told that a bunch of Kharijis, those who have left Islam, are being brought as war captives, the enemies of Islam. So for Allah, they're gathering their pebbles, their stones, they're gathering their arts, their cheers, they're gathering all their decoratives to decorate the city. The family of the Kharijis are coming, so that upon entrance, when they see the children, they have their pebbles and stones ready. When the heads of the shuhada are being paraded in the city, they have their stones ready to hit them. Perhaps it was these last injuries that were seen on the head of Imam al-Hussein by his daughter Ruqayya in the ruins of Sham. Ala lanatullah ala al-qawm al-zalimin. وسيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلب يا حسين.
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد. Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein.
Kashiyabas namare jate, Kashiyabas namare jate. काश अब्बास न मारे जाते, काश अब्बास न मारे जाते. इस तरह लगे तीन अकबर के कलेजे मिसला, इस तरह हो तीन सादा देख खैमों में फुगा. यूं ना ज़ैनब के सहारे जाते, काश अब्बास न मारे जाते, काश अब्बास न मारे जाते, काश अब्बास न मारे जाते. दोनों बाजू वो शहनशाहे वफा के थामे, लाश अब्बास पेशबी बुका करते थे. भाई तुम बाद हमारे जाते, काश अब्बास न मारे जाते, काश अब्बास न मारे जाते,
काश
अब्बास न मारे जाते. गर्दन शाह आप यूरन में न खंजर चलता, यू न खुर्शीद इमामत सर मक्तल डलता. यू न सर ने रूप सारे जाते, काश अब्बास न मारे जाते, काश अब्बास न मारे जाते, काश अब्बास न मारे जाते. या हुसैन या हुसैन, अल्लाहुम्मा सल्ली अला मुहम्मद वाल,
अल्लाहुम्मा सल्ली अला मुहम्मद वाल मुहम्मद. थैंक यू आयान फॉर योर ब्यूटीफुल रेसिटेशन ऑफ दैट नोहा. नाउ आई वुड लाइक टू बिगिन विद द क्वेश्चन एंड आंसर सेशन. I'll pick up where we left off yesterday, answering the questions that we failed to get to, and then hopefully we'll be able to finish the questions that we have today as well. Starting from yesterday, one of the questions, Sheikh, that has been asked is, it says, Agha, you mentioned in your hadith that Salman is one of our Ahlul Bayt. Even though Salman wasn't infallible, would he have the same status as the other Imams in this world and hereafter? The question is from a brother, and he goes on to say, is there a difference to moving to a country for the quality of life and that to serve the Imam of our time? This is from the same brother, the two questions.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you very much. Both very good questions. The first thing to note regarding the first question is that the Ahlul Bayt have said, not only regarding Salman, there's a few other people that they have said, he is one of us, the Ahlul Bayt. Let's note that and think. I will present something that comes to mind and scholars have said, but when we know something the Ahlul Bayt themselves, the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt have said, then we should know that that is correct, but now start to think about what that means. So, does Salman minna Ahlul Bayt means that Salman is comparable to Amir al-Mu'mineen? No, it doesn't mean that. Is he comparable to the rest of the Imams? No. Ahlul Bayt, if you look at the words, there is a bait of Nubuwwah. There is a house of Nubuwwah, a house of prophethood. There are those who are members of this house of prophethood, like the Imams, like above the Imams, their mother, the lady Fatimatu Zahra, which for another time explaining that what we mean by above the Imams. Fatimatu Zahra is someone that we can't really understand the things that are about her. She is part of Ahlul Bayt al-Nubuwwah, but she's not an Imam. She doesn't have a responsibility of an Imam. She has a different response, but she's part of the Bayt of Nubuwwah, the House of Nubuwwah. House of Nubuwwah is not a physical house. It is the it's where those who are related to prophethood, close enough, where they, the prophet, or the other members tell us these people are part of those who are close and connected and included in what is related to prophethood. So that means basically Salman is so close to the Imams, the prophet, that they have taken him within their house, the house of prophethood. Okay, and that is something that we can acquire. We can have that. It's not only Salman. We shouldn't think that it's only Salman. When we know that it's that door is open to whoever decides to enter, the Ahlul Bayt, the Imams, the Prophet, Fatimatu Zahra will welcome them. But they need to be Ahl. The word is Ahlul Bayt al-Nubuwwah, worthy. One of the meanings of Ahl is worthy. Person needs to be worthy of being there. And that's when the door opens and they're welcomed by the Imams and the Prophet to enter the house of Nubuwwah. We hope that, inshallah, it's given to us. Regarding if there is a difference between moving for quality of life or for serving the Imams, there is obviously a difference. I think it's very clear, and I think the brother who asked the question sees that difference. Perhaps he's wanting some input about what I think the differences are. What I want to clarify that we mentioned yesterday as well is that since we are to go to the Maraja, we have got to ask them, is it okay to go for quality of life? They have said it is okay as long as you don't need to sacrifice your religion. And from what we have seen and our experience is, I was born in the U.S., the belly of the beast, and lived here. It's not something that you need to sacrifice your religion in order to stay here. Therefore, the Maraja not only have approved of it, they have sent representatives. There are representatives that the leader and other Maraja have in different European countries and in the United States of America, despite all the difficulties, all the stuff. I don't know if you guys have seen one of the Sayyids that has been in Qom for a few years now. I don't know exactly how long. Sayyid Muzammil Zaidi from Houston. He has been taken in. I don't know if they've released him on bail yet or not, but the accusations are taking Homs to the leader's office in Iran. Despite these difficulties, there are representatives that have religious representation. So that tells us that they don't consider being here, even just for quality of life, to be something that you are required. Some people may sacrifice their religion to excel and to join basically the system, but living here doesn't require you to sacrifice your religion. Therefore, for someone to leave and their Islamic hometown and to move to these countries is not forbidden. They're not. Nobody's committing a sin by simply living here. Okay, that needs to be made very clear. But besides that, is there another difference? Well, yes, there is a difference, and that is if somebody moves here, like for instance, if a representative is sent by one of the maraja, and their intention is really not to come here and enjoy the bounties, that's not their purpose. Although when they come here, it's available, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says it's halal, then you take advantage of it. But they're not here for that. And at any point they need to give that up, they will. They're here for Allah. They're here for difficulties, like the companions of the Ahlul Bayt, like the companions of Imam al-Husayn. If somebody comes here for that reason, then obviously, not only is it not haram, it can be even wajib, and it can be jihad fi sabilillah, and somebody coming here just only for the quality of life is not going to be jihad fi sabilillah. Last point on that is that regardless of what we came to these countries for, continuing our stay here, our intentions can change. We can sit down and say, Ya Sahib al-Zaman, when I decided to move to this country, the only thing I was thinking of was quality of life. That's what my understanding was. But now that I've come here, you have guided me to see beyond that. And I want to stay here to be part of your struggle here. You teach me, you guide me, help me do that. And then from that point onwards, then their stay is going to be for purposes of jihad in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Thank you, Sheikh, again. This next question is regarding the event that happened in Pakistan where a Sheikh was arrested for reciting Zayat Ashur in public. So the brother asks, considering the current circumstances in Pakistan where reciting Zayat Ashur in public means cases are being registered against Shia Muslims, what do you think is the responsibility of the Shia youth in such times in such a country? Should they keep quiet or speak against such injustices on social media when it makes them more vulnerable to physical attacks and becoming a victim of false judicial cases?
I think Karbala has taught us that we shouldn't be afraid of the physical consequences. So let's put that aside. That's not a concern. If saving Islam, saving the remembrance of Imam al-Hussein is going to require me to be falsely accused of something I didn't do and be imprisoned, then so be it. If Imam al-Hussein said, swords take me and tear me apart, if that is how Islam will live, then we should at least be able to say that, if that's something which is good. Now, in Pakistan's condition, I'm not from Pakistan, and I don't know the details. I'm going to just comment based on what I just heard. If they want to make it, first of all, this isn't the first time that Ziyarat Ashura is being recited in public in Pakistan. Okay. I've never been to Pakistan, but I know the Shias of Pakistan. I know this is not the first time the Shias recited Ziyarat Ashura in public. You have your Husayniyas, you have all your masjids, you have all these different avenues of performing the A'mal, and you do Ziyarat Ashura. This is not the first time. So it means that there's an agenda that the government, which is unfortunately not representing the Pakistani people, Shia or Sunni, let me make this very clear too, insight again, let's not lose sight of that. It's the kuffar through the Saudis that are causing the government to take these stances, which means the kuffar want to make life difficult for the Shias in terms of practicing what is Islamically correct, and there is absolutely no problem with it. They want to make that difficult for mu'mineen. And one of the reasons why they would do that is to get people to be obedient to them. A lot of times when tyrants make orders, it's not about them wanting that particular thing they're asking for. It's about breaking the spirit of the people who are not giving in to the authority. Once the believers give in to this command, they stop Ziyarat Ashura publicly, then that opens the door for other things. So if the Shias in Pakistan want to live in an environment where at any point the government wants to decide to limit a Shia activity that is an Islamic activity that is prescribed by the Ahlul Bayt of Islam, for them not to be able to do so whenever the government decides, if you want to live under those conditions, then don't do anything. Don't do anything. If you want to live where you are ahrar, you are free to decide based on what your imams have told you, you have got to make sure now everyone's going to do Ziyarat Ashura publicly. Do Ziyarat Ashura publicly. You want to come and arrest me? How many of us can you arrest? How many of us can you arrest? How many of us can you cause trouble? If you pick on me, I'll be glad to. Okay, pick on me. But then there's others. How many of us? You pick on me, okay. One, two, three. There's thousands. You can't. If this move takes place, they will. And then, alhamdulillah, you have some, at least some good ulama that are going to be doing their share. But the people need to also do their share. My understanding is, you want us to be obedient, we're going to show you and teach you a lesson not to make us obey you against the words of the Ahlul Bayt. The Imams have said, Ziyarat Ashura is good every day of the year. Imam As-Sadiq salamullah alayhi is the one who taught us Ziyarat Ashura. And he told us, according to the hadith that's found in Kamilu Ziyarat and also is found in Nisbahul Mutahajjid of Shaykh At-Tusi, both of them very old books, reliable books. Ziyarat, Kamilu Ziyarat, more reliable. That's where the Ziyarat is found. And if they have said it's good, we are going to go by that. We're not going to obey your command over our Imam's command.
That's perfect. And it was brought to my attention as well. This was the first time I think that I was broadcasted live on television. So whereas it might have been recited in public before openly, it was the first time it was, you know, so opening broadcast to the media.
Yeah.
So they just used it to like blow it out of proportion.
Even that, I'm not very, I can't speak definitively on the matter because I would need to have facts. But it's very highly unlikely in my mind that even this is the first time that it was televised. Maybe in the recent history, but I strongly doubt that this was the first time it's televised. Now, people need to look into that to see if that is the case or not. But besides the point, the objective is not, it's not because it was televised. This was, this is planned for a different reason, and people need to be aware of that.
Yeah, that's perfect. Another question that I had here is from a brother. It says, how do you recognize MI6 ulama on social media? So basically, any ulama who might be paid by the Taghut or might be serving an ulterior motive.
Absolutely. We need to have the insight not to need to hear names, but to identify. If we are able to understand the goals of Islam, number one. Two, understand the goals of the Shayateen, the Taghuts, these MI6 is one of them, CIA, Mossad, the French intelligence, the German intelligence, anyone, all these are, they have their wilaya, the wilaya of the kuffar. So it doesn't matter which one of these it is. But of course, the worst of them, the evil geniuses, are mostly either MI6 or CIA. Even Mossad doesn't get close to them. They are, the reason why they make progress is a different reason. They're not as good in their evil as these two are. Anyhow, if we identify their objectives, what they're trying to do, if we know these, then when a person speaks, we're able to tell this message is the message of Shaitan although the guy has a turban on their head. That message is a message of the Ahlul Bayt, even if the guy doesn't have a turban on their head. So we need to spend time, and it's difficult, it's not easy to have that insight, to be able to do that, but we do need to do that. The reason is, we may not, the reason why I say we need this, instead of me saying, for example, this person works for MI6 or that person does, they don't need to work for MI6. They don't need to. MI6 does not work in that way. Even according to the records we have, there's a book that's been published of the it was called the Intelligence Service at the point, at the time of the British Empire, that created Wahhabism. He did not go and present himself as an intelligence service agent to Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, the one who created this ridiculous ideology, this absolute deviant ideology that has been spread with the oil money of Saudi Arabia. He didn't present himself as that. And Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab had no clue he's working for the British government. Yet he did exactly what they wanted. So some of these people, they may not be paid, they may not even know. And if you tell them, like, no, I hate MI6. Okay. Yet they're doing what they want. They're very clever. They're not stupid. They're not dumb. They're not going to come and knock on your door like with a card like they show on their Hollywood movies. This is the FBI. They're not going to do that. They're going to come and talk to you with a real nice beard and a sajda mark on their forehead, really nice oud or, I don't know, musk or some sort of religious fragrance on with a big tasbih and all of that, and come and talk to you and maybe talk about a few Imam Hussein stories or the 12th Imam stories, get you to think that this guy is so religious. And then you start listening to them. And gradually, because you hadn't identified the goals of Islam, the goals of the Tawhut, you didn't realize this guy is going against Islam. He looks very religious, but he's not doing anything religious. He's doing everything against religion. So some of these people may not even know they are working for those agencies, but they are repeating with those people. That's one reason why it's important that we don't require a person to tell us this person works for MI6 or whatever. The other reason is there may be certain people right now, but then tomorrow another fitna arises, a new figure is put up. A new figure. When that new figure comes and they haven't been already identified as someone who's working for them, they may even have a track record of being a good person, but then suddenly they start going astray just like Zubayr did. Zubayr was one of the strong supporters of Amir al-Mu'mineen. After the demise of the Prophet, he was willing to fight. He even went with his sword. He tripped and his sword fell. Otherwise, he wouldn't have allowed Amir al-Mu'mineen to go to the masjid. He was there with his sword that serious. Then he becomes the opponent of Amir al-Mu'mineen later on. We can't judge people and say they're not ma'asum. We've got to judge everyone based on Islam. Amir al-Mu'mineen, this is part of insight. He's says, don't judge Haqq and Islam based on people. Judge people based on the Haqq. Identify what Haqq is. Identify what the truth is. Identify what Islam is. Identify what the Quran says. Read the Quran. Connect with the Quran. Connect with proper sources of what the Ahlul Bayt have said. Based on that, say, well, this guy who up to this point was saying what was right, from this point onwards, he's not saying what is right. I'm not going to go with him. He doesn't tell me where Islam is. The 12th Imam tells me where Islam is. So it's important that we understand Islam. Brothers and sisters, please read the Quran. All of you. You're not, from what I know, most of you at least, are not Arabs. I'm not Arab either. I don't have an Arabic background. Alhamdulillah, Allah gave me the tawfiq to learn Arabic. If anybody can do that, go ahead and do that. There are ways of doing that so you can connect with the Quran directly. And if you can't take those courses, read the Quran, then read the translation. Read another translation, a third translation. Compare them. Think. Allah has given us a mind that we use for other things. We don't use for understanding His words. Understand the Quran. Try, especially the younger brothers and sisters in your teens, in your early teens, mid-teens, late teens, read more and more of it. Read more and more of it. Allah will guide you through that. He will show you, He will give you that insight. It's the Quran that gives you the insight. And if you do so, you will realize that everything you heard about the Ahlul Bayt now has depth to it. You've heard a lot of things about the Ahlul Bayt, but a lot of it is very superficial. But when you start reading the Quran, you combine the two thiqlain that the Prophet said. He said, I leave two things behind, the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt. We've heard things about the Ahlul Bayt. We haven't heard too much of the Quran, or we haven't spent time analyzing that too much. Spend time analyzing. It starts having depth, and inshallah, that'll give us the insight to recognize the goals of Islam. And then spend time, you know, obviously, thinking of what the enemies are doing. Identify the enemies as enemies. The first thing that they want to try to do is for you not to consider them enemies. They are enemies. The British government is an enemy. The American government is an enemy. Don't be afraid of it. I'm sitting here in Los Angeles, California, all right? And we need to say this. The United States government is an enemy, not to only Muslims, to the non-Muslim Americans. Forget about other people worldwide. The non-Muslim Americans are being treated as enemies by the American government. This is a fact. Don't let them fool you in thinking anything other than that.
No, you're absolutely right on that. Like, we've seen this with the wave of the Black Lives Matter protests as well, and the cruelty on Black people as well, that not all citizens in America itself are treated equally and fairly as well. Okay, leading on to our final questions now for the day. A sister has asked, what were the major flaws in the Ummah of Rasulullah which made them ignore the message in such a short time and so conveniently after he passed away? Which moral vices led to this collective attitude of complete disregard? And then on top, it's a follow-up question, is that how did the followers of Imam Ali manage to preserve their iman and not follow the crowd, follow the masses?
It's a very good question, but I can't answer it in a few minutes. I'll put a couple of points forward since the question is asked. But I will preface it by saying that take that question and think. Think of whatever you've heard. And if you find what you've heard not to be convincing you of why this happened and how it happened, which it shouldn't convince you. That's we have not, on a collective level, come to convincing answers in regards to why that happened. And that causes us to be vulnerable to the same mistakes. And so we need to do that. One thing that was mentioned in the question that is important and it needs to be emphasized is that we should not think that the people who made that grave error were people who were not Muslimin, people who didn't care about Islam, people who didn't believe in Islam, people who didn't believe in the Quran, people who didn't believe in the Prophet, people who didn't like the Prophet, people who hated Ali ibn Abi Talib. No, that's a very incorrect. If you analyze history in that way, you are bound to make mistakes in terms of what the conditions were, and therefore you're going to not take the lessons of that history. No, they were people that put their lives on the line for Islam. They are people that gave half of their belongings, wealthy people. We're not willing to do that. The Prophet told them upon, shortly after entering Medina, he split them up or he paired them up, a muhajir, someone from Mecca or from elsewhere that had migrated to Medina, and one of the Ansar, the people of Medina. He paired them up and he said, you need to split everything. So the person who's coming from as an immigrant doesn't have anything. The person who lives in Medina, some of them were wealthy. They had to split everything. The Prophet said, they did it. If the Imam of time comes and tells me, split everything with this person that just came here and you don't even have a clue who this guy is, I wouldn't do that. Okay. These are people that are very much believing in the Prophet. To that degree, they put their lives on the line many times, not once. These are the type of people that ended up making that grave error. And not all of them committed sins. It was an error for many of them. But we need to learn from that. It was still an error. It doesn't make them not have, you know, it's not like they didn't do anything wrong. But it's that either the guilt is less because they didn't realize what's happening, or they were completely oblivious. They were completely clueless. And so they don't have any guilt. There were some people that didn't have any guilt, but what happened was wrong. They were part of it, but because of their level of intelligence and insight, because they couldn't understand, they're not going to be held accountable for something they didn't really understand what is happening and what the responsibility is. Very confusing. So that's something to note. But the fitna after the demise of the Prophet was a very, very difficult fitna to be able to see through it and to see what Fatima al-Zahra saw, salamullah alayha, and do based on what she saw, as she did, was extremely difficult. In very few words, if I may, Amir al-Mu'minin Fatima al-Zahra went to the doors of 40 of the top-ranking Ansar. At night, they convinced them, you need to come and be willing to fight your own comrades in other fights. This is how it was. We all were together with the Prophet and we were fighting together against the enemies of Islam. Now we are going to be willing to fight each other. That's not an easy thing to do. We may be buddies. We may have been buddies before this. Now this happened. We're splitting ways. Now willing to fight the other. I mean, we need to convince them, look, this is how important it is. You need to come with your swords ready. One night, next day, by morning time, the thoughts, like, they were no longer convinced that they need to do that. They were afraid. What if this is the wrong decision? And other elements came in. They ended up not coming. The next night, Amir al-Mu'minin goes again. Third night. But Fatima al-Zahra, salamullah alayha, besides that, she realizes that this is such an important matter that she needs to sacrifice her life for. If people are not willing to change, I have got to be willing to put my life on the line and get killed behind the door so that this matter does not go down in history without this type of resistance. That's something that the followers of Fatima al-Zahra today, none of us have truly understood. We think it just so happened. No, it didn't just so happen. She knew what that behavior of hers is leading to. To come to the conclusion, not emotionally, not because it's her husband, not because she got emotional about her father, Ghadi. It's not an emotional thing. She understands the importance of wilayah and the person governing the ummah to be so important that lives should be lost to preserve that in history. Nobody else understood it in that way. They were good people. They weren't bad people. Some of them regretted later on. Some of them became good companions of Amir al-Mu'minin during the 5 years of governance. At the time, they didn't understand. They failed. They failed to understand. They failed to realize. And that's a much, if we say Ammar was someone with its insight, although he was there with Amir al-Mu'minin, he wasn't one of those who didn't come. He wasn't one of those who had to go to their door. That's another instance of the insight of Ammar. He did understand it, but not on the level of Fatima al-Zahra. They didn't understand, none of them at that time, the extent, the vision of the future that Fatima al-Zahra was seeing, that if it goes this way with Ali ibn Abi Talib as the ruler, it'll go this path. And if that changes to this other person, it's going to go this path. None of them understood that. And so none of them considered it as important as Fatima al-Zahra saw it. That's a much greater level of insight that we need to learn. But usually we discuss those in Fatimiyya, inshallah. When that time comes, I hope that a speaker that can touch on that topic can enlighten you.
Yeah, no, that was perfect. That was wonderful, actually. We can also draw parallels to Sayyidah Zainab as well, where when she stood up to Yazid, that evil was obvious out of the atrocity that he had committed against Imam, whereas some of the politicians that Imam Ali faced and Imam Hassan faced were a lot more astute, and they realized that committing such a grave mistake is just going to unmask them. So the jihad of Sayyidina Fatima and Imam Ali and Imam Hassan is just as great. We just lack the basira, as you said, to see through it. And thank you, Sheikh, again for your wonderful answers. Very insightful, very deep as well, providing us with a deeper layer and understanding of history, as long as how we can relate it to modern day life. I'd like to thank you again for your wonderful speech and your wonderful answers as well. And I'd also like to thank Reciter Shayan Mehdi for his recitation of the Holy Quran, Brother Ali Mujtaba for his recitation of the Salam, and Brother Ayan as well for his recitation of the Noha. And I would urge everyone to join us yet again tomorrow, same time, between 6 to 7.30 p.m. Dublin time. We only had one or two questions remaining today, so inshallah they'll be covered tomorrow. And any other questions that may arise, you can note them down and send them on to us again tomorrow, and inshallah we'll do our absolute best to answer them. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Take care.
Alaykum.